Hello and welcome to the Everything is Black and White podcast. Andrew Musgrove here alongside Newcastle United editor Aaron Stokes. This is our usual Monday show, but for reasons we're doing it here on the Thursday. We will be back on Monday next week, and from there on in it will be a typical Monday show. But as luck has happened, Aaron, we are here on the day that the fixtures have been released for Newcastle United and of course the rest of the Premier League for the 2022-23 season. If you guys tune in and wanting some transfer updates, we will of course bring you that as well later in the show. But we'll kick off with the fixtures, and Newcastle will start at home to Nottingham Forest. I did say to you, I had a dream that that was the actual fixture. I woke up this morning, this is legitimate, I woke up this morning thinking that Newcastle were going to get Nottingham Forest. I can't tell you why, but that's what I did actually have a dream about, so I'll take credit for that. I'm excited for that fixture. I think it's going to be a really good atmosphere. I think being at home, the first game of the season is going to be a big occasion, especially with the transfer window. We wait to see Newcastle sign, but I just think the way the season ended against Arsenal, you know, everybody wants to be at St James's Park. There's going to be a buzz. War flags already asking people what they want as the first display of the season. I think it's a really good fixture for Newcastle to start the season with.
Yeah, I think you'd say it's probably the ideal fixture, to be honest. Like you say, the end of the season that so positively on that high against Arsenal at home, you know, people were itching to get back, and you know, what fixture could you have wanted than Forest making their, you know, long awaited return to the Premier League? They're going to be up for it. St James Park's going to be up for it. I'm really looking forward to it, and I think, you know, we waited 14 games last year for a win. As Lee Ryder touched on this morning, I think they've got a very good chance of opening their account early doors this season with that game at home, or if not, you know, at Brighton or Wolves later in that in the month.
It's going to be interesting. Jack Colback potentially returning to St James's Park as well. We know he's a man that divided opinion while he was here, so there's a bit of a more context into that. Interesting team of Forest. I mean, where they were to where they've come to, you know, with the promotion. I mean, they were near the bottom of the Championship, if not bottom, when the manager took over. He's done a fantastic job, and it's a great story. I mean, we've got Newcastle United legend Frank Clark, of course, a legend of both Newcastle and Forest. I'm sure he'll be looking forward to that game, no doubt, end up coming up to St James Park to see it. And what the other good thing is as well, at the moment, it's a traditional 3 p.m. kickoff. And I know that means that a lot of people have to follow it on the radio or hopefully through our live blog, but I am a big fan of the traditional 3 p.m. kickoff.
Yeah, look, it's the weekend, everyone's off. You've got that time to go out and get some food and drink before the game, and then 3 o'clock, I was just about to say under the lights there, it's not under the lights, but 3 o'clock on a Saturday, and yeah, as we've said, hopefully getting off to a good start. Two, you know, massive historic clubs, and, you know, a lot of people I've seen this morning are, you know, they sort of bemoan Fixture J and they say, well, why does it matter, you play everyone twice? But, you know, I still get that buzz, and I think after, you know, seeing the fixtures come out today, I'm more excited for the season than I maybe was yesterday.
I think there is an element of excitement, but I am in the boat of the people you mentioned there. You know, I like that when the fixtures come out, because, you know, the season's not too far away. But for people who worry about, you know, a tough run of games, and then they look at the games before that and say, oh, we have to win this game, that game, because the games afterwards are tough and where the points are going to come from, you play everybody twice. I'm not a fan of pointing out big dates or big games for everyone, because I feel they won't become big games or big dates for people when in the context of the season. Do you know what I mean? Like, so if you need a win, that game suddenly becomes a big game. But we're sitting here right now in the pre-season, you know, whoever in November, it's not a big game because we don't know where Newcastle are going to be. Yeah. Maybe I'm just
Cynical,
eh? But of course, you know, you're always excited for the fixture release fixtures coming out and seeing who we're playing. It's a shame. I think that, you know, unfortunately, we're not playing Sunderland. There was a bit of a debate, wasn't there, on social media about Newcastle versus Sunderland. It'll be interesting to know your guys' comments, actually, pop them in the comments. Do you miss Newcastle versus Sunderland? I suppose while we're on that subject, Aaron, do you miss the game?
Not really, no. Someone asked me this the other day, you know, do you want the derbies back? And if I'm honest, no. And I feel like I'm still so scarred from that, you know, 6 or 7 year period we had where I would wake up and I would dread them, you know, and then we'd go watch the game and it would just be another defeat. And I just used to think, I don't think I'm ready again to be hurt. And I know, look, it's different this time around. You know, Sunderland have had so many years in the doldrums, and Newcastle are obviously, you know, the richest club in the world and all that. But I would still be, you know, really, really full of fear on that morning. But I mean, look, you never know. Next season, should they have a good season, the Championship, it might be a reality, but I'm happy for them to have another couple of years in the Championship, I think.
See, I'd love them. I'd love the Derby back. And I get what everyone says, the fear and the trepidation of it all. And it's a horrible build-up. And of course, if you lose, it's a horrible week. But there's just something about it. It's that buzz. You can't really describe, can you? And, you know, yes, when you lose, it does hurt. But I think they've been down there long enough, and I would welcome them back in the Premier League, or at least, I mean, a cup game to get a taste of that derby again.
But it's weird because it is literally a 50-50 split. Yeah. And I saw this debate on Twitter the other day, and it wasn't as if everyone was saying, you know, oh, I really want it because there's nothing like a derby game. There's a lot of people in my boat that are, like I say, is still scarred from that sort of period under De Canio and Poyet and, you know, a decade ago. So it's interesting to see that literally fans can't decide and they can't make their mind up as to what they want. But yeah, it's interesting.
And Daniel Duffy there says it would be nice to get Sunderland in the cup. I mean, for me, I know we're going off on a bit of a tangent here, but do you know what? Part of me wishes it to be like a bit like Manchester City, Manchester United were a few years. But you know, when Man City won the league on the final day of the season, mm-hmm. and they beat Manchester United to it, could you imagine, like, you haven't just won the Premier League, you've beaten your nearest rivals to it as well. Mm. And I get the flip side of that is if you're Manchester United in that situation, you're like, oh, we've not only lost the Premier League, we've lost to our local rivals. But just that, you know, you're not just trying to be the best in your region, you know, you're trying to be the best in the country. And it would, for me, I guess I'm going to be in the minority here, I'm sure there'll be plenty of comments coming through. I would love to see both teams battling at the top of the Premier League.
I think you're probably in the minority there. I don't think a lot of fans will agree with that there. I think they'd prefer anything than to see Sunderland even second in the table, never mind challenging for Newcastle the title. So yeah, I don't think I can agree with you on that one, to be fair.
I thought that might be your response. But back to the fixtures. As much as you know, I do detest looking through them and going, oh, here's the top nine dates and what have you, we have picked out a few, haven't we? Because there are a few points in the season, I think, given what happened last season, where you can look at and say, well, how far have Newcastle come? What were we doing at this point of last season? So do you want to just discuss a few of the things that we've picked out?
Yeah, I think, look, you look at that August and Forest, it will be a fantastic day at St James's, but, you know, the big eye-catching games in that sort of first five are Liverpool away and City at home. And, you know, we were joking this morning in the office that it's, oh, look how far Newcastle have came, and, you know, can they really stick at a City and Liverpool this season? If they have a big summer, I still don't think they're going to get anywhere near those two next season. We've seen this season just gone the level that they are. They're streets ahead of even the likes of Chelsea and Arsenal. So Newcastle have got a big job catching up with them. But that'll be a good sort of barometer as to where they are in August, those two games. September looks, you know, on paper, I mean, obviously we said this last season at the start and we all know how that went, but September, you look at Palace at home, West Ham away, Bournemouth at home, winnable games. Obviously, you know, this season's going to be different with the World Cup in November and December, so you've only really got four games across that period. But I mean, Leeds, New Year's Eve, what a game that'll be. The City will be absolutely, you know, electric for that one. And then you look, really, you know, you're sort of looking at the run-in in the last four games. Obviously, we don't know where Newcastle are going to be. You'd like to think they're not going to be in any danger this time around. But Arsenal at home and Leicester at home, Leeds away and Chelsea away, it's quite it's tricky running that. So, you know, let's just say, fingers crossed, you know, Newcastle are sort of in the hunt for a top six place or top seven place going into May. You know, you're going to be battling Chelsea and Arsenal, who are going to be up there as well. So it's a tricky end of the season, I think, that is.
I mean, looking, you know, we said off camera that maybe the 10th game is one to look out for, because that's often the where the managers will say, you know, judge me after 10 games, certain managers used to say. But I think after round about 10, 11 games, you will get the sense of, you know, the players who performed well towards the end of last season, are they still at that level? So the likes of Joe Linton, who we will assume will be, you know, starting at the start of the season in that midfield position, you know, but will he continue in the same vein that he finished the season? I hope so. I think he will do, but we'll get a nice sense of where things are. You know, is Callum Wilson going to be fit at that stage? Is Dan Byrne going to be at the level of maybe pushing for an England call-up? I think after 10, 11 games, you do start to get a sense of where things lie for players in terms of form.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you just look at those first 10 fixtures, in those games, Brighton, Wolves, Palace, West Ham, Bournemouth, Fulham, Brentford, all games where on paper you think, right, we've got a chance there. If we have a sort of similar start of the season as we did last year, and teams that are easily beatable and we're throwing away, you know, points, we're dropping two here and three there, like you say, we're getting 10 games into it, thinking, right, maybe we need to scale back the optimism that we've had pre-season. Everyone's thinking, oh, look, it would be great again at Europe. Maybe we need to sort of, you know, rein it in a bit. Likewise, or sorry, on the flip side, if they've won 7 of their first 10 games, we're thinking, right, okay, this is, we're cooking now, do you know what I mean?
You know, it's a fine balance, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned there, potentially Newcastle, when you get to those last run of fixtures in May, might be in the hunt for a top six place. For me, I think I'd be happy with them breaking into the top 10. I think anything else is a bonus, because we've got to remember they're still at this building stage. You know, we've seen with the transfers, and we'll get onto the window shortly, that it's not all going their own way. I think many people expected that to be. So they might have a bit more cash than other people in the transfer window, but they're not. You know, it's been on social media, there is a Newcastle United tax, it is a real thing. So you don't know who they're going to get in. It's not all going to go to plan. And of course, you know, football is one of those things you can never predict. You look at the opening run of fixtures, and you would say on paper, Forest is winnable, Brighton's winnable, Wolves, you'd think, you know, again, is probably a winnable game, Palace and Bournemouth. But then you never know, do you? You just don't know. These teams could turn up. Man City could have a bad start to the season, and Newcastle could end up beating them. So it's a bit of a lottery. But for me, I think Newcastle aiming to get into that top 10 is a realistic ambition. And whatever happens, if they get above that, get a good cup run in, that'll be a bonus. But I mean, for me, there's a couple other games I think will be important to look out for. Aston Villa and Everton in October. So Everton on the 19th of October and Aston Villa on the 29th. I think they'll be interesting games, because, you know, you can see, you look at Manchester City, you look at Liverpool, Man United, Spurs, and you go, that, so certain people go, oh, well, that's how far, let's see how far Newcastle have come. Let's see how they do against these sides. But we've got to be realistic. They are well behind these sides, and they're going to be for the next 2-3 years until everything clicks into place. But really, and more Aston Villa than Everton, because I do think Everton will struggle next season, but I think Aston Villa are on their level, and they have another side. You know, they've already started the window really well. Aston Villa will be a team I think Newcastle will be battling to try and break into that top 10, that top 8. And that, for me, that Aston Villa game in October is probably the barometer of how far Newcastle United have come.
Yeah, I would agree, because when you look at them on paper, the two squads are going to be similar. As you've touched on there, Aston Villa have probably had the start of the summer window that Newcastle fans wanted, you know, for their own club. You know, they're out the traps quickly. They've got some good signings in. You know, as been mentioned, Diego Carlos, who was a long-term target in January. And, you know, just weirdly enough, it happens to be the 14th fixture of the season, and we all know Newcastle obviously didn't win any of their 14 games last year. So it'll be interesting by the time that Villa game comes around to see, one, how they've done compared to last season. Don't think they'd do much worse. But also, where the two clubs are, has Villa's transfer strategy paid off? You know, is Gerrard sort of struggling? So yeah, I think that. And also, I mean, that Villa game, the 14th fixture, that's right before the World Cup. So, you know, I think the barometer needs to be the 10th game, the 14th game. And when we're going into that World Cup and we've got a 2-month break, Newcastle really need to be sort of around that top half mark. You know, they need to be sort of already clear of the relegation zone by then, so that they can sort of kick on for the second half of the season.
Do you think, even though, so, you know, they come through, survived, and we've said previously there's a clean slate going this summer, it's easier to sell the club to potential players who may come, like Botman, like Etekier. But given the attention on the club, the ambition of the owners, do you look at these fixtures and say, well, you know, if the season starts like it did last season under Steve Bruce, and to a degree Eddie Howe's reign as well, because he didn't get off to the best of starts, is Eddie Howe suddenly find himself under pressure?
I think it depends on the manner of the performances. You know, if Newcastle are battling and going down and picking up the odd result here and there, is he going to be awarded more time? He's got a lot of credit in the bank, one with the players, one with the media and with the fans as well, and the owners love him. So look, these owners have got great ambitions for the club. I've got no doubt that in a couple of years we might be sitting here with like a Pochettino or a Mourinho or someone of that real stature at the club. But I think from what we've seen so far, I think we'll give them time. Don't think there's any pressure on them this coming season to, you know, say, right, we want European football, and if we don't get it, you're out. This season, as you've said, is a building block. It's trying to make that sort of bridge the gap between 14th and 15th to sort of the top six. So, look, I don't think it'd be under as much pressure as Bruce because, as I said, he's well-liked, he's done well so far. But it'd be interesting to see the fan reaction if we get the 14th game and we're 17th. Fans can very quickly turn, can't they? And all that credit sort of goes. So it's interesting, but I think Eddie will be quite relaxed about his own future.
Yeah, and I think the club won't be ran and the same decisions won't be made as we've seen at other clubs where takeovers have happened, where there's big pressure. I don't know. I mean, this is just my gut instinct, but I just get the feeling things are going to be ran a little bit differently. You know, and I think Eddie Howe, the first bad run, you know, he'll be given a chance. But I also think that it, you know, any bad run won't be as bad as we've seen previously under the likes of Steve Bruce or Steve McClaren. You know, because I think he's a talented manager and I think he has got a big future ahead of him. I know, you know, people are maybe down the line expecting a Mourinho or Pochettino, but, you know, if he does well, and the man of Stavely's alluded to this, there's no reason why he can't be here in many years to come.
Yeah, she said, you know, to be the next Fergie, I doubt he'll do 26 or 27 years, but I agree with your point. I think it's going to be ran differently than it was under Ashley. Especially if, I know this probably wasn't your point, but I think if they are languishing around the relegation zone, the owners will act. It wasn't like Ashley with McLaren and Bruce where he kept them hanging on. At times you felt like, despite the fan base. And also what I think is interesting is Dan Ashworth coming in. You know, he's spoken in the past about the identity they had at Brighton, and he said that you can't chop and change managers every 6 months, because what we want to do here is, at Brighton, it was, we want to bring players in that Graham Potter wants and that the chairman wants, and that we're all pulling in the same direction. If we're chopping and changing managers all this, you know, for example, if Howe goes and they get Potter, for example, you know, it's not his players, you know, it's not his team, he hasn't chosen it. And I think Ashworth wants that real cohesive feel between the manager, the squad, himself and the owners.
Well, you've only got to look at Watford or Everton to show that constantly chopping and changing managers doesn't work.
Get you nowhere.
You mentioned Brighton there. You know, Potter has had some bad runs of form, and obviously this season ended quite well. But even this, I mean, the previous season, you know, there were some bad run of games in there, but they stuck by him. And I think that's a really interesting point you make there. There's some really good comments actually going on in the chat. We are live on Facebook as well. And there was one just earlier about the fitness, and we've seen Alan St. Maximin training on the beach while he's on holiday. We've seen Joe Willock running. Well, I think it might be America, early morning jogging, you know, and then he's in the gym. And, you know, this is nothing new. The players, you know, the Instagram stories last season of players doing this, but there's an added incentive, isn't there, this time around? You know, players want to be part of this journey, and they know, especially the likes of Joe Willock as well, where the midfield is very oversubscribed in that position, that they have to be at the top of their game, and that's not just form, that's fitness as well.
Yeah, look, it was so well documented last year that the players weren't fit enough, the pre-season training wasn't right. And I mean, it's no way for any club to run, let alone a Premier League. Now, our colleague Kieran Kelly did a very good article the other week where he sort of explained Eddie Howe's part and gift to the team after Burnley, and he basically said that as soon as that full-time whistle went at Burnley and the season was done, Eddie Howe was giving them their training preparations for the summer and saying, this is the fitness plan you need to stick to before pre-season so that we're not playing catch-up. You just have to look at the level of fixtures that they've already got planned. Benfica, Atlanta, Bilbao, top-class opposition. So I think Howe and the players are going to have this mindset of going into pre-season and treating it as if it's the start of the season, so that by the time that first game comes on against Forest, they're ready. You know, they're already drilled. You know, they're already as fit as they need to be. To make sure that we don't have a repeat of last season.
Because you saw it took Howe time to get the players up to his level of standard and fitness that he likes in his teams. And we've spoken about previously Callum Wilson's comments about Newcastle not being, you know, ready for the new season. So, you know, you are right there about the catch-up. And, it's such a basic thing, and yet such an important thing. And it's refreshing to see Eddie Howe, you know, doing that to the players. And the players getting on board as well. Because one thing, you know, you go on holiday and you could maybe run one every 2 days. I do a light little jog. But, you know, it seems the players are really buying into this when they could be forgiven for just, you know, putting their feet up for a little while.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it goes back to what you've just said. You know, players that are maybe on the fringes of the team know that they have to be at their best this season, or they're going to be out the door as that sort of, you know, new level of players comes in. You know, Isaac Hayden, as you know, I spoke to him last week about his exit, and he said that we've been having discussions in the squad that, you know, this club is going to bring in better players, which is brilliant for the club. But we know that, you know, we've only got a short lifespan in this squad at the minute, so we need to make the most of it. And I think that's what the players will be thinking. We've seen St Maximum this week on his holidays running. You know, it's a big season for him, and I think he knows it as well, that it could be make or break. So it's good to see that, you know, there's been this culture shift from when Howes came in, and it can only be a positive going into the start of the season.
100%. And I mean, we'll stick with that Isaac Hayden exclusive. You spoke to him, what was it, 24 hours after he left Newcastle United to join Norwich on loan. You know, it is a loan deal, but there are certain criteria that if met, it will turn into a permanent deal. We don't know what they are, but we think, you know, the bar will be set relatively low. Just tell our listeners, what was he like to speak to?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. I mean, everybody knows his character and the type of person he is. And I actually said this to him when I was interviewing. I said, I've supported Newcastle United all my life, and I've never seen a player get that type of reception when he left. Every single comment you saw on social media was positive, and, you know, there's very few that can leave and every single fan is saying the same thing.
And especially from where he came from, yeah, as well, because let's not forget that game against Cardiff when he got sent off.
And he was like...
He'd made it clear he wanted to leave. He made it clear that in the January after he wanted to leave. Obviously, he'd had some... there were some things going off, happening off the pitch. But he bounced back.
Yeah, he did.
A tremendous professional.
Yeah, tremendous. And I mean, I asked him about it, about 2019, and how, you know, he really wanted to go. And he said that there was a lot of factors. One, which really stood out to me, he was like, you know, Benitez was a big factor. I thought Benitez was going, so I wanted to go. He was like a father figure to me. But he eventually said that, you know, the club priced him out of a deal. They were asking for far too much, and he had, you know, very good Premier League offers. He was going to be closer at home, which he felt he wanted to go. And the club were basically just, you know, they had a price tag on his head that no club really wanted to pay. But yeah, he said, look, he was being very, very thankful for the fans, for their support. He said that he's had some fantastic memories. You know, he feels like him and his daughter are going to be sort of honorary Geordies for the rest of their lives. But he said also that football's all about time, and it felt like the right time for him to go. And Norwich was an easy deal to make. You know, he knows the sporting director, Stuart Webber. He's been at the facilities before. He said it was a no-brainer. And he just said the timing felt right. And he said, I was really struck by this because it goes to show what type of man he is. He said, the way I see it, and other players might see it differently, but the way I see it is, if I can contribute to this team and leave it in a better place than I came and I've done it, then I've done my job. And he was like, I arrived in the Championship and I'm leaving and we're an established Premier League club. And I just thought, you know, that was really good. You know, you can tell we say it all the time, but he's an honest player. You know, he really, really cared about this football club. Mm-hmm. And I think it really does mean the world to him that fans have seen that.
Because it's a brave move in many ways to drop down a level into the Championship, and he is very experienced there, but it's a very tough league, especially if you come back from an injury as well. But also, you know, certain players, you know, and I'm not saying this is the case at Newcastle necessarily, but certain players might just sit there and take the paycheck. They know they're not going to get into the first team, let alone maybe the first team squad. But they're happy to still be part of that journey. And that might be because they want to experience it and they want to say, look, I was part of that Newcastle squad that got to Wembley and won an FA Cup, even if I only played 30 seconds or whatever. But for Isaac Hayden, you know, he knows time is short in football. Careers don't last forever. And it's all about getting that first team opportunity and playing regularly first team football. And fair play to him. He has gone. He's gone, got his move, and he's left Newcastle at a time when things are really, really exciting.
Yeah, and he touched on it. He said, look, he's disappointed. Any player, you know, wants to be a part of this journey, especially when you're in already at the ground level. But he said, while it was disappointing and, you know, he was a bit upset about it, he was also, you know, predominantly excited because, like you say, the timing for him's right and his family. And, you know, he said getting the response from fans when he announced his exit sort of, you know, reaffirmed the decision for him, because he's leaving now. His reputation's not tarnished. He's leaving, and as we say, you know, it's a loan deal, but it looks like he's going, you know, for good. But he's leaving at the right time for him.
And the reaction as well reaffirmed that it was probably the right decision, because no one was crying out saying, oh, why have you let him go?
Yeah.
They were saying, yeah, we can understand why you've gone, why the club will let you go, but you'll be welcome back with open arms every time you come back.
Yeah, we've touched on it before, and we'll touch on it later. You know, the midfield already at Newcastle is so bloated without them even, you know, bringing anyone in the summer. So it would have been a case probably of them getting, you know, starts here and then time on the bench and stuff, like we've touched on with Longstaff and other players. So, as I say, it goes to his character that, you know, he just wants to play football and he's happy to sort, well, not happy, but, you know, he's ready to leave the journey at, you know, the most exciting point, really.
Definitely. And you mentioned there the midfield. Just before we do that, if you listen on the podcast channel, please remember to like and follow the podcast through your podcast provider. Totally free to do. Just means with every new episode we upload, you will get a notification to say it's ready to download or listen to. And the important bit, if you can leave us a rating and review either on Spotify or Apple, and help us get the numbers up there, we really do appreciate that. Makes or allows us to get the episode out to a much wider audience. We've broken through the target of 200 in the last week. Some really nice positive comments. You know, even if they're a bit negative, as long as they're honest, we don't mind. We're all here for the feedback. So just if you get the chance, pop down and do leave us a comment. It'll take you 30 seconds and it really makes all the difference. Right, we're on to transfers, which I know a lot of you guys and girls will be waiting for. Today, Newcastle United fans have woken up with links to James Ward-Prowse and Matheus Nunes from Sporting. Now, two quality players. I mean, James Ward-Prowse, he is one of my most favourite players in the Premier League. What he can do with the ball at his feet, you know, free kicks, corners, he's unbelievable. And I think he will be destined for a bigger club than Southampton. Now, 6 months ago, Aaron, you know, if we'd been linked to James Ward-Prowse, which Newcastle were from certain outlets, you know, you'd be absolutely buzzing. You think, yeah, there's a good chance here. But now I look at the midfield and I look at it and think, well, it's not a priority. That's not to say it couldn't be improved, but if Newcastle have got like an £80 million budget, let's say, then the large part of that's going to go on a striker and a centre-back, you would imagine. It's not going to go on James Ward-Prowse, who is going to cost you the best part of £50 million.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, as we've said, the priorities this summer are elsewhere. You know, they want a striker, they want a centre-back. And that midfield is already bloated, you know, with Longstaff tying down that new deal. It sort of feels like if they do improve the centre midfield, which, look, they could by the end of the summer, you know, we don't know where this team's going to be in a couple of months. And it feels like this transfer window's been going on for months and it's only been on a couple of days. So how quick things move. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if they did buy a centre midfielder, but I think before that happens, they need a striker and they need a top quality centre half. But I mean, especially James Ward-Prowse, he would dramatically lift the standard of that midfield, which is already probably the strongest area of the pitch. Walks into a lot of teams in the Premier League, English, knows the league. As you say, though, Southampton don't want to sell, especially to a sort of rival who's going to be next to them in the table. So it would probably cost, when you add on the Newcastle tax as well, you know, you're talking 40, 50 million for a player who's, you know, approaching or is sort of, you know, nearing the end of his career, maybe.
Because also if they do go out and sign a centre midfield, obviously Lucas Paqueta is another one who's been linked, another one who's going to cost 40, 50, 60 million perhaps. You look at it and who would drop out? Because we mentioned there Joe Linton's form, for me, he's a shoo-in to start in that position. Guimaraes is another one who's guaranteed to start in there. And then you look at it, well, you've got Sean Longstaff, you've got Joe Willock, John Joe Shelvey. Now, Eddie Howe, from what he said, really, really seems to like John Joe Shelvey. Now, for me, if I was the manager, he would be the one that would be dropped out. If someone like Forrest came in with a bid, for me, I would consider it if it was a decent amount of money. But from what you read in between lines, from what Eddie Howe says in his press conferences, and also, let's be fair to John Joe Shelvey, the way he stepped up as well, I can't see him being moved on in the next year. And that then presents another element to, well, okay, if you go and sign a James Ward-Prowse or even someone the next level down, can you really see John Joe Shelvey dropping out?
Shelvey's such a difficult one because he divides opinion. You know, we've got, you know, colleagues in our office who, you know, think he should go. We've got others who really rate him, and the stats when he did play compared to when he didn't this season for Newcastle was remarkable. You know, Newcastle, I think with him during that run from December to March, I think they didn't lose a game when he started. I think when he didn't play was when they sort of started to drop points. And I just think he's literally got 9 lives. Under Benitez wanted him gone. He survives. Bruce, he was awful for pretty much 18 months, survives. Eddie Howe comes in, this take what happens, he gets sent off in the first game with the owners watching his sign, you think, right, he's gone. And he just raises his game again, and he just somehow manages to stay in the team with usually good performances for a couple of weeks. Admittedly, the last couple of months he was fantastic. But it goes back to what we said a lot on this podcast, and it's about the levels that they want to go to. Shelvey is fantastic for the mid-term. Long-term, he probably doesn't have a future. But this is, again, why we're saying, do they need a centre midfielder this season? Fans in the comments will say, yes, we do. We need to strengthen all positions. But I think we saw at the end of that season, Shelvey, Jolent and Bruno, Willick, Longstaff was more than good enough as a five to rotate against. I mean, look at that Arsenal game at the end of the season. Longstaff ran the show. If they can just find a bit of, you know, consistency there for them, if Willick can find that goal-scoring form that he had on his initial loan deal, I think they're absolutely fine with them five midfielders. But it's so tempting, isn't it, when you've got Paqueta and all those big, you know, fancy names linked. I do agree with, though, if push comes to shove and they get another, you know, top-class midfielder, and I think Shelvey's the one of the three to drop out. Joe Linton's been too good in that new role, and Bruno's obviously the first name on the team sheet. So it's a headache for Howe, but it's a good one to have, and it's one we haven't had in a long time.
It's a positive dilemma, and I've written a piece over on Chronicle Live about what it says about the new owners as well, the fact we are sitting here saying the midfield isn't a priority, because turn of the year, it was. But then they've gone out and bought Bruno Guimaraes, you know, one of the best midfielders in Europe, and he's been fantastic. But equally, the players like Willick, like Joe Linton, Shelvey, and then, you know, Sean Longstaff towards the end of the season have also upped their game. So that's testament to the coaching staff and to the players themselves as well. Because, but more than that, like, the issue of the midfield has been a long-term problem. It's been like that left-back area, hasn't it? It's been a long-term issue where they've gone out and got loan deals, or they've been linked to this and that, or the managers have openly said, I want to improve this, I like this player, but Mike Ashe never went out and got that player. You know, Benitez wanted to sign Tom Kearney. Steve Bruce thought he'd had the now Leicester City midfielder. And it was just refreshing to see in January the owners look at the issue and go, okay, they need a centre midfielder of good quality who can run up and down the pitch, you know, can pick a pass, get stuck in, and they went out and bought Bruno Guimaraes. And I think it's a sign of things to come. These players are going to be these owners are going to be proactive rather than reactive, and perhaps when Mike Ashley reacted to things, the damage really had already been done.
Yeah, and I think that's why we've seen already a week in the transfer market that a centre back has got to be their priority, and a striker as well, because these owners know that for all Callum Wilson is a fantastic striker, that first game of the season against Forest, he could be injured and it could be another 3 months out, and we're relying on Chris Wood again. They've got to go out and get a striker this summer, which we know they are looking for. But also at the same time, for all Fabian Schär's lifted his game, and for all Dan Burns being a good addition, they made it clear in January that they need a top-class centre-back. They went all out for Botman, they went all out for Carlos, and eventually, you know, the sort of Newcastle tax did force them to retreat. But as you've touched on, these owners know that these are the priority areas that they need to strengthen, and that's what they're going to go out and do.
The spine of the team, that's what they're trying to build, isn't the spine of the team. And you've got Bruno Guimaraes there, you've got Callum Wilson to fit there, and then, you know, it'll be interesting to see about Botman if he does come in, and we will get on to Botman in just a moment. But there's a bit of movement in the youth as well. We've got Charlie McArthur, who is one who's been linked, Kilmarnock, a young lad. I mean, you know, we don't know how, you know, far this deal has maybe been talked about. You've also got Alex Murphy as well, who's signed from Ireland. Dan Ashworth has come in. There's a big emphasis on youth, and we spoke last week about how he said that if Newcastle need a player in a certain position, going to the transfer window isn't necessarily the first option. So when we see links to like McArthur and the signing of Murphy, and you look at how Anderson's done as well, it's a really exciting time, I think, to be a Newcastle United fan and potentially having a young star to cheer on, you know, in that first team.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Eddie Howe himself's touching it in press conferences that, you know, he's really keen to, you know, promote more academy players throughout the first team whenever he can. And, you know, we have seen at times that, you know, the likes of Lucas De Ball and players like that have made the bench. Elliot Anderson will get the pre-season to sort of show what he can do before probably a loan deal out. But you just have to look at what Dan Ashworth did at Brighton to see that he's always got an eye on the next young thing coming through. Tarek Lamptey, I mean, to get him from Chelsea for $2 or $3 million was a steal. They've got a lot of young players that they've brought in from abroad and they loan out straight away to aid their development. And I think we've seen with the signing of Alex Murphy, who's, you know, came in from Ireland and was one of the highly rated players. We've now got the link in the last couple of days from the Telegraph that Charlie McArthur's, you know, a deal's nearly done for that. And I just want to read a couple of things about Charlie McArthur, because I wrote a piece on him yesterday, and admittedly, you know, he's 17, he's only played 3 times for Kilmarnock. I'm not going to pretend that I've watched him loads, but a couple of things have stood out from what other people have said about him. So this is Scotland under 17 boss Brian McLaughlin saying the other month, "I felt Charlie McArthur was incredible today. He should be proud of that performance. He's got a huge future ahead." Tommy Wright, who played for Newcastle, now coached him at Kilmarnock. "The biggest compliment I can pay to Charlie is that the lads treat him like a 26-year-old. I don't want to stick labels on how good he is, but he will have a very good career." And Kilmarnock's captain said, Ewan Murray said, "I have no doubt that with the right support network around him and if he keeps his feet on the ground, that he will have a massive future. He's an unbelievable talent." Now, in years gone by under Mike Ashley, when on earth have we signed a player that was getting those sort of rave reviews at 17? It was never anything like this. So it goes to show that, you know, any sort of young players that are getting brought in, you know, for all Santiago Munoz could be a fantastic player, we sort of felt under Ashley was brought in for his name, didn't we? Or that, you know, we weren't sure about it. The type of young players that they're going to go out and get now, you know, are the absolute cream of the crop of their age groups. And I think this is what we're going to see more and more when Ashworth sort of gets going.
Mm. Interesting as well, Peter Ramage was manager of the 18s. He's now been moved over to assistant loan coordinator, working, as far as we know, alongside Shola Amiobi. And I spoke to Shola last week, and, you know, he has his critics because some of the loan deals haven't worked, and, you know, he did at certain points defend Mike Ashley. But I'm intrigued, I think it'll be the right word, to see how Dan Ashworth can maybe mould Shola Amiobi into a better loan manager. And when I spoke to Amiobi, he was open and honest about learning from Ashworth. And the thing that really stood out was he was just excited. And I know, you know, it's easy to be excited when you're a fan. You know, that's what he is at heart. He stripped back everything. He's just like everyone else watching or listening to this. He's a Newcastle United fan. But he's just really excited to get started, to get these, you know, these youngsters developing and getting them out to clubs to help that development. And he's really excited about Elliot Anderson as well. And it was just lovely to see someone at the club in a senior position being really excited about the future.
I know, I mean, when have we seen that in the last couple of years? Actual, you know, senior members of staff being excited about the future. And I mean, Shola was actually in the press box with us a couple of weeks ago, and he was chatting to Mark Lawrence, and I'm sort of half eavesdropping into his conversation. And he was saying that, you know, the club, you know, the whole atmosphere has changed, and they're going to go into this new season thinking that, you know, top half is where they want to be. They don't want to be languishing down the bottom now. And I mean, as you've said, how long has it been since we've had that sort of optimism, you know, on Tyneside? So, yeah, it's great to see. And I think it will be interesting to see how he works with Dan Ashworth, who had a really, really crucial role in Brighton's youth setup. And the aim was always get these young players in and sign them early, but don't just let them sort of fester in the youth teams. Let's get them a good loan deal. Let's get them a proactive move to sort of get them minutes at a higher level. So I think if those two can work together, then we'll see a massive improvement in that department.
Definitely. I mean, you know, he worked closely with David Weir. It's Brighton. David Weir is now his successor. So, but, you know, David Weir wouldn't have been an expert at sending youngsters out on loan. So it is a learning curve. And I think it's really, really important that they've got someone like Dan Ashworth who can help Shola and now Peter Ramage, you know, just learn in these roles, because it's, you know, it is, as someone's just said there in the comments, Kev, it is a learning game. And hopefully they can have more success like they did with Kel Watt and Elliot Anderson and Matty Longstaff out on loan. Three examples there of how to do it right, getting regular game time and achieving success as well with their loan clubs. And fingers crossed more of that can happen. A lot of people asking, Aaron, about Botman and Etekier. What's your latest understanding on the chase for both of them?
Yeah, so obviously Botman, I mean, it feels like the saga that's never going to end, doesn't it? I mean, we were discussing this morning, when do you sort of call a line and draw a line under it? From what we understand, you know, he is sort of waiting for Milan. And, you know, as I wrote a piece on yesterday, you sort of can't blame him in a sense. For all, Newcastle United is an exciting project who are going to do very well in the next couple of years. You're talking about Serie A champions, Champions League football, you know, the home of Maldini, Nesta, all these fantastic centre-backs from years gone by. You know, we do understand that Newcastle and Lille, you know, do have a feel that they're almost there on that feed, is just up to the player now. And it all just depends on sort of Milan's takeover situation. You know, they're in a takeover progress of themselves, and that is sort of causing their delay their side, but it looks on that front that he does want to go there, which obviously is a shame. But look, these owners will know that this was a possibility and they'll have other options drawn up. We've already seen sort of things being sort of drip fed to the media that sort of says that they're already looking at other targets. So I wouldn't be surprised that they walk away from that one soon enough and sort of and look at another.
On that, and in general, with the season starting so early and the centre-back looking like it being a priority, a striker as well, how important is it that the owners know when just to walk away? Just to say, look, right, we've given you enough time. This offer's been on the table. The season starts on August 6th. You know, we need these positions filled with quality. We haven't got time to wait around. How important is that they are ruthless in that sense, where they're not going to be taken for mugs and they're not going to wait around forever?
Yeah, they've got to be, but I think we've already seen in the last 6 months that they are. You know, in January, you know, they probably could have got a deal over the line for Carlos, but they said, you know, we're not going to be taken for mugs on the transfer price. And, you know, it was a similar thing with Botman, where eventually they walked away and said, look, we'll raise it in the summer. And Dan Byrne was in like that. You know, gone are the days where I think we're going to be waiting on deadline day for, you know, is this deal going to get over the line? I think by that first game of the season, I think Howe will have his team in place. And I think any late deals will be done if they have to be, if an injury happens, or if, you know, how things, you know, we've started the season and this deal, you know, we maybe need a bit of strength here. I think we'll go into August knowing the bulk of the squad, and I think, look, what we're now middle of June, they've got 6 weeks. Like I say, I think they won't be pressured into paying this tax, and I don't think they should be expected to. And I think they'll say, if you don't want to move to us, fine. If you want to sell us this player for 10 million more than you're going to sell to Villa, then that's fine, we'll walk away. And I think that's the right way to do it, because we don't want to pay over the odds for a player because we're trying to rush deals through.
Yeah, and once you start paying over the odds, then it's very hard to get away from that, isn't it? So, and we did see in January they weren't going to be held to ransom, and you know, they were ruthless. And on Etekier, picked up an injury, didn't he, last week? It's interesting because he is a very young player, and you know, people speak very highly of him. And if he does arrive, it'll be for quite a substantial deal. Even, you know, you count the ad odds and what have you. But I just look at it, I think if you need a player to really rival Callum Wilson, is he right now at this moment that player to do that?
No, I don't think he is. And look, me and you have talked about this on the podcast before, that this shouldn't be seen as their striker deal. This shouldn't be the man that's going to challenge Wilson for the number nine. For one, he doesn't even really play as a number nine. You know, he plays off the left. He's 19, he's very raw. He's only had one season at the top flight in France, and that was sort of marred by injuries. You know, he's had three different hamstring problems since February. Instantly, that alone puts you off a little bit. His age, the fact that, you know, he's coming to a new league at an age where we don't really know, you know, how much potential he's going to hit. So, look, I think it's an exciting deal if they can get it done. The club medical team will be well aware of this hamstring issue. But I think, as we've said before, it needs to be Etekier and a number nine, or an approved number nine at that. I don't think, you know, you can rely on him. For all, it's going to be an exciting deal. I don't think that can be the only attacking option that they bring in this summer.
Kev there says he looks very promising, but we need someone proven to score goals, which is right, because you want someone to come in and push Callum Wilson. That's not going to be an easy task. You know, there's players linked every other day, but again, the price tags are unbelievable. And I mean, you saw how much they paid for Chris Wood with a decent Premier League record, but not a £25 million kind of record, you would argue.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we've seen in recent weeks the likes of Calvert-Lewin are going to be linked in Ivan Toney. But it goes back to the Ward-Prowse and Southampton issue. They don't want to sell at Newcastle. You know, Toney, I think they're being priced at £50 million. I mean, look, he's a fantastic player and he's done very well for Brentford since they came up, but I don't think he's the man to, I don't think he walks in that team over a fit Callum Wilson. So it's as we've touched on before, you know, it's about finding that levels, and when they bring in this number nine, it needs to be someone that you think, yeah, look, he can't take it off Wilson. Or if Wilson's not fit, we know he's going to hit the ground running and not have that sort of Chris Wood 3 month spell where he's sort of out of form. So it's a very difficult situation this summer. I don't envy the owners having to do it with obviously the Newcastle tax and trying to find that perfect number nine that they're looking for. But I think it's crucial, as like we say, Wilson, you know, for how good he is, he's just not reliable enough fitness wise. So it's crucial that they get it right.
It is indeed. It's going to be an interesting summer, and we'll keep you up to date on chroniclelive.co.uk. We have a daily transfer blog where we get all the rumours in there. We get all the analysis and opinion and news as well from our writers, including Aaron, Lee Rydak, here and Kelly. So do head over and put that in, bookmark that into your browser and keep that open over the next couple of months. Just want to finish on Mike Ashley and Derby County now. Derby County, I mean, I feel for their fans. They've been through the ring, haven't they? I mean, not only getting relegated, but everything with administration and so many false dawns of new owners. And unfortunately, recently, they've had yet another one. Now, Mike Ashley has made no secret. You know, he's interested. For whatever reason, the administrators haven't in the past picked him as their preferred bidder. When this was initially floated, many, many months ago, I've got a Derby County, one of my good mates is a Derby County fan, and, you know, with Newcastle getting taken over and everything looking promising, he's down in the dumps with his, worried about his club. And he asked about Mike Ashley many months ago, and I said, well, if you want an owner who does the bare minimum, doesn't have any ambitions, doesn't have any, you know, desire to take the club further than just surviving, Mike Ashley's your man. But now I'm thinking about it and looking at the situation Derby County are in, so close to the new season, you know, a real lack of funds, issues over the stadium. I do think Mike Ashley wouldn't actually be the worst case scenario for Derby County. You know he's got the funds and you know he will do enough to make sure you survive, and that will probably work in League One to get them up to the Championship.
Well, I think that's the key point there, is that he's got the funds. And, you know, Derby have had two or three sort of false dawns where they thought, right, this is it, am I getting taken over? And at the final stage, you know, these owners from abroad all of a sudden don't have the funds, and you're thinking, well, you know, how are they getting this far in the takeover process? You know, people have, you know, had a go at the Premier League owner and director's test, but some of the EFL takeovers in the past couple of years have been scandalous. So if it's the choice between administration or Mike Ashley, you're picking Mike Ashley. But the caveat is that, look, he will probably pump money initially, or he'll give them a loan initially to make them, you know, to stay in business. And look, they could easily come back up from League One. Rooney's done a fantastic job. It looks like you'll stay. But as a long-term solution, you would fear for the club. I mean, you just have to look at not even the money he puts in, but just the murkiness around himself, you know. The fact that it's jobs for the boys, the fact he'll never come out and speak to you unless, you know, it suits him. You know, he gives one interview every 2 years. But look, Derby are in a crisis. As you say, the season's fast approaching. We don't want to see another club go out, especially not a club like Derby with all that history. So Derby need now an owner who's got the funds. Mike Ashley can do that. And in the short term, it probably wouldn't be the worst thing, but I never thought I'd be saying this. You know, I never thought I'd be championing him to take over another club. But
you know, if he's learned from the previous mistakes, which I'm not sure he maybe has done, he puts the right people in charge. You know, you don't have to spend loads and loads of money. You just need to have a bit of ambition and desire to better the club. Where Derby are now, I mean, becoming a mid-table regular Championship club, they'll snap your hands off for that. Mike Ashley, I think, could, you know, set that up. Of course, Newcastle fans listening to this, watching this, will say, well, what are you talking about? We know what the last 17 years have been like. But I do think that was actually one of the biggest regrets as well. Newcastle could have been an established Premier League side, top six side, had Mike Ashley realised the potential, not only the club, but of what he had as well. You know, the funds were there.
Yeah,
he just chose not to.
Yeah, the funds were always there. The funds weren't in wallpaper, as he liked to say, you know, when he was defending himself. But look, it was we all know at Newcastle it was 14 years wasted, and, you know, he inherited such a fantastic club, and by the end of it, it was a shell of its former self. Derby are obviously at the opposite end of the spectrum, and I'm not saying that, you know, Derby are at the lowest ebb now and Mike Ashley's going to all of a sudden turn them into this amazing football club again. I don't think he's in it for that. I think he's in it for the money and the money only, as we've seen with some of his sort of high street purchases. And even though the relegations at Newcastle were his mistakes and he had to own them, they got straight back up straight away because he had to put that money in when it mattered. So yeah, look, if it's the choice between going bust and actually, you know, trying to keep them afloat, then you've got to give it a go. And look, you never know. He might learn from his mistakes, but I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Be an interesting one to follow. Well, guys, that is the end of the Everything Is Black and White podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in. Please remember to like and follow the podcast from wherever you are watching or listening to. And head over to chroniclelive.co.uk to keep up to date with all the latest Newcastle United news.